Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, the Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Internationally known legal ethics professor Richard Zitron's work as a trial lawyer placed him on the front lines of fighting systemic racism, pervasive elitism, and injustice against individuals in the legal system. In Trial Lawyer, he shares details of the most compelling cases he's encountered and exposes the dilemmas he's faced throughout his one-of-a-kind career. The profound, the consequential, the shocking, the bizarre, and even the humorous, Trial Lawyer brings to life what it means to represent people against power. From his first case as a young law student on the famous and highly politicized San Quentin 6 case, and throughout his 40-year career, Zitron has worked on dozens of cases that underscore the inherent biases of the legal system towards people of color, the poor, the less educated, and those who just don't appear to fit the mold of whatever society considers normal. His personal stories about him bring the reader inside the courtroom to experience a unique cast of characters, strange but true facts, brilliant trial tricks and tactics, and not so brilliant ones that failed miserably. Each had its own lessons about social justice, fairness, strategy, ethics, morality, and more. The book that we're featuring this evening is Trial Lawyer, A Life Representing People Against Power, with my special guest, attorney and author, Richard Zitron. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Richard Zitron.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Thank you so much. A very, very fascinating story and quite unique for this program. Let's talk about what you write in the introduction. You said that this is a book of reflections on the most compelling cases that you have encountered during your life as a trial lawyer. Tell us what most of these cases consist of and what you found about ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances.
Well, Dan, most of the cases I did after the first one that you mentioned were ordinary cases that didn't get an awful lot of publicity. Some got some, but not a lot necessarily. But they had extraordinary features, bizarre things that occurred, surprises that occurred in the courtroom, sudden changes in defense tactics or sudden changes in prosecution tactics, surprise witnesses, all kinds of unique and unusual things that happened. And as a storyteller and as someone who's written a few other books, I was encouraged by people to tell my own personal story. So this started out as kind of a memoir about these cases. But as I got more deeply into it, given my background as a legal ethics professor for 40 years, it wound up being a lot about how to deal with disadvantaged people, people who haven't had a fair shot in the system, and also how to deal with my own sense of my own responsibilities to my clients.
You write about that responsibility, that it supersedes all others. Explain further.
Well, we have what we call a fiduciary duty. It's a term that's used mostly with finance, banks and so on. But lawyers have a fiduciary duty to their clients, and it's simply to put the interests of the clients ahead of their own interests. And that's not necessarily easy to do. Sometimes it's hard to figure out where your own interests stop and the client's interests begin. But the main thing that I learned from the very first day I was practicing law was that my obligation was to put my client's interests first and try to protect that client before worrying about myself. It's a basic principle of ethical lawyering.
You say that it's especially important when it appears that the system is being unfair to a client, doesn't it?
Well, that's true. And my experience has been largely with clients for whom the system did not give them an even break. A lot of times that's because they were poor. A lot of times they were people of color or other people disadvantaged by the system. Or as I suggested, people who just don't fit what the society as a whole considers normal or ordinary behavior. And those people have a much tougher row to hoe than the average person who doesn't have those handicaps. So there's a special responsibility that I felt for many, many of my clients along the way, because they weren't getting the fair shot that other people might get.
You also in this book address, when it comes to criminal cases, there have been two questions that you've been asked more than any others. What are those two questions and what are your answers to those two questions?
Well, the first one is, how can you represent people if you know that they're guilty? I think both questions actually get subsumed and put together in that single question. How can you represent people if you know that they're guilty? And the reason is that, of course, everybody is entitled to defense, and nobody is guilty until really a jury comes back in and says so. There are all kinds of circumstances relating to a case that are extenuating circumstances that explain the situation. So that in one case that I had very early in my career, a man named Elvin Drummond, he killed another man, but it was in self-defense. So was he guilty? He had committed a homicide, but that's not a crime. He hadn't committed a murder. In the San Quentin 6 case, which you mentioned, Dan, the underlying facts inside the lockdown of a major United States prison were so unfathomable that no one could really ascertain what happened. And to this day, no one really knows what happened. So to assume that somebody is guilty because they're accused, or maybe even because there's an extraordinary amount of evidence, only tells part of the story. Now, there's another reason here. Our system grew out of the system that existed in England in the 16th and 17th century. And at that time, they had star chambers in England in which the accused would be told by the judge that even if the jury found them not guilty, the judge was finding them guilty.
Wow.
And in one case involving William Penn, one of the founders of Pennsylvania, the jury was told that if they didn't come back with a guilty verdict, they too would be thrown in prison. That's not the kind of system we wanted in the United States. And so to a certain extent, we reacted against that by creating rights to people who are accused of crimes so that nobody is convicted of a crime unless a jury finds that they're guilty.
Throughout your extraordinary legal career, and what we're talking about in this book, your first murder case, and you'd only been a lawyer for 3 years. So tell us how you came to be working with David Mayer and how you came to represent Johnny Spain and how you came to work on the San Quentin 6 case.
Well, I had come out to San Francisco to do my third year of law school, and I had been out here a week when a friend of mine told me that he had just turned down a job with a fellow named David Mayer working a highly publicized 6 murder case in San Quentin State Prison. And he recommended that I go up and interview with David. And he and I hit it off. And David hired me on the spot to be a law clerk on the case. I was paid $5 an hour by the Marin County Superior Court.
Wow.
That's the county which San Quentin is located. Of course, $5 an hour was more than it is now, but it
sure
still wasn't very much money. David turned out to be a great mentor, a very, very dedicated lawyer, a former prosecutor down in Southern California who had gone into the Air Force and seen the difficulty that accused people had of getting a fair shake in their courtrooms and court-martials, and it kind of revolutionized him and turned him into a defense lawyer. When he got out of the Air Force, instead of going back to the DA's office, he decided to come up to Northern California and start defending people, including a lot of people in San Quentin State Prison.
Now, based on that, he got a reputation. And so people that were in prison were talking. And so they're one of the defendants asked for him to be appointed his lawyer. What happened in that regard?
Yes, he had gotten a reputation for doing a great job representing prisoners. One of the San Quentin Six, named Willie Tate, reached out to David and said, "I'd like to have you appointed to represent me in this case." And David presented that request to the judge in the case, whose name was Henry Broderick. Broderick was not very fond of the San Quentin Six defendants. He saw them as guilty people. He also, frankly, saw them as six people of color who were not common in his own personal experience. And so he pulled a fast one on David and appointed him, but not to represent Willie Tate, instead to represent Johnny Spain, who was the only member of the Black Panther Party among the six defendants. And that got Johnny and David off to the wrong foot, a situation that had been created, frankly, by the trial judge.
So he was assigned this case or appointed this case that was far more difficult with what the judge and prosecutor felt was the most guilty of the six defendants?
Well, Johnny was the one most closely associated with George Jackson, who was a leader of the Black Panther Party and was killed himself on the day in which the San Quentin Six violence occurred. And there was a history to that violence that I can explain briefly if you would like me to.
Absolutely.
It started in early 1970. George Jackson had been sent to Soledad Prison, where he came under the tutelage of an inmate named W.L. Nolan, who was one of the founders of radical Black prison groups. One day in January of 1970, a guard shot into the yard at Soledad Prison, which is down near Monterey, and killed three Black inmates. And when the grand jury examined the situation, they exonerated the guard from all three shootings. About 2 weeks later, a guard was thrown from the tier. Tiers are the stories of cells that exist, the usually three or four or five tiers that are like apartment floors, was thrown from the third floor tier into the yard and was killed. And Jackson and two other people were accused of killing that guard in retribution for the killing of Nolan. Those three became known as the Soledad Brothers. After that time, Jackson was sent to San Quentin. And eventually, the events of August 21st, 1971 occurred, which Jackson was killed by guards and five other people died. In the interim, in August of 1970, after the accusation against Jackson and the other two Soledad brothers, Jackson's 17-year-old brother invaded the Marin County Courthouse, went into a courtroom with guns, kidnapped a judge and a district attorney, and left. And outside the courtroom, when they got into their car, there was a shootout. Three of the invaders were killed, including George Jackson's brother, Jonathan, and the judge was also killed. So this created an atmosphere of extraordinary fear and concern in the community, both law enforcement community and also the African-American community and the other communities of color in and around San Quentin State Prison. And it was in that environment that a year later, the San Quentin Six case arose and six people were killed.
You're right that there's a little more involved too, because the gun that Jackson used, was found to be purchased by Angela Davis, who had been fired from UCLA for being a communist, then was reinstated, then refired for inflammatory language, such as calling cops pigs. And so a couple of months after this incident, Angela Davis was charged with murder, wasn't she?
That's right. And Angela Davis, by that time, had already become extremely well known because of her outspoken statements at both Berkeley and then later on at UCLA. And she had been terminated by UCLA, which was then reversed by the courts. So she was already very well known. And when it was found that the guns were supposedly purchased by Angela Davis, this was a front page event. She was accused of murder, along with one prisoner who was in that car where people died, who survived. And she became a fugitive for a period of time. She was soon captured and quite soon thereafter put on trial and was acquitted of all charges.
Let's get back to working with David Mayer on this case and this, all the lessons that you did learn, all the work that you did do on their behalf.
Well, I've got to tell you, Dan, the most extraordinary day I had in the law was the day I first went out to San Quentin to meet Johnny Spain.
Right.
I had no idea what to expect. Yes. I had never been in a prison before. I think I had only been in a jail once or twice. And the security at the prison was extraordinarily high in light of these homicides. We were brought into a tiny little visiting room that was about the size of two phone booths back to back. Separating us was a shield, impenetrable shield, that went all the way down to about 2 inches above a little narrow table. Johnny sat on one side of this, and we sat on the other, and you couldn't even hear clearly. The sound was muffled by this thick plastic. An extraordinary thing happened. David extended his fingers, the tips of his fingers, under the metal grid that was at the bottom of the plastic, and Johnny extended his fingers, and they shook hands by shaking their fingers together with each other. That was the only way of doing it. And then I did the same thing. It was really an extraordinary thing that there was such a separation between our ability to connect with our client in a meaningful way. While we were in those rooms, we frequently didn't talk because there was a San Quentin guard sitting 2 feet behind Johnny, listening to everything we said. So we would often take ballpoint pens and scribble what we were saying to the person we were talking to, pass the note in the little space between the partition and the table. And once the note had been read, we'd take the note back and scribble over it with the pen in circular motion so no one could possibly read it. It was the only way we felt we could have a confidential communication with our own client. And to me, being a kind of white suburban kid from a relatively privileged background, it was just such an eye-opener. I think I was in shock.
You're right. That also, it was like an otherworldly experience when you say that the extent of the animosity towards the defense team.
Oh, yes. We would get there at 9 o'clock in the morning and put in a visiting slip for Johnny. Now, these guys were all locked down in a place called the Adjustment Center, which was the most highly secure area at that time, the most highly secure California prison, San Quentin. They were locked down for at least 23 and a half hours a day and sometimes for more than that. They got showers only 2 days a week. They had no ability to visit anybody other than their legal team. And we were told, nevertheless, when we got there at 9 o'clock and asked to be able to visit with them, that for one reason or another, there was no escort to bring him to the visiting room, or he was busy doing something else, or he was taking a shower, or there was no availability of crew at the adjustment center to bring him over to where we were. And sometimes we waited for 3 or 4 hours, cooling our heels in the visiting room before we even got to see him. That was pretty typical. The animosity that we received was palpable. It's beyond my belief to even consider the animosity that the six defendants were facing.
You write that you began everything with to learn all the relevant facts by reading transcripts from the first court appearances in 1971, and also that you learned of the prosecution's theory of what they believe had happened and the charges subsequently.
Right. Well, there was an indictment. It was 368 pages long, and it described the narrative of what supposedly happened. And then there were transcripts of the first couple of hearings, after which the case was suspended or stayed by the appellate courts. And it was stayed until from October of 1971 until just before I arrived on the scene in June of 1973. The transcript of the grand jury presented a very convoluted and somewhat unbelievable theory. And the theory was this: a white lawyer from a privileged background, in fact, from a family of Connecticut senators and congresspeople and stuff like that, named Stephen Bingham, supposedly put a Spanish World War II gun called an Astra into a small tape recorder that he brought inside San Quentin prison to visit Johnny Spain,
right,
to visit George Jackson. Supposedly, according to the prosecution, somehow the gun got transmitted to Jackson in the visiting room. And Jackson supposedly hid the gun under a wig that he was wearing, an Afro wig that he was wearing, and took it with two clips that would be inserted into the gun back to the adjustment center after the interview. And when he entered the adjustment center, according to the prosecution's case, the guards looked at him. Most of them didn't see anything wrong. One ran his fingers through Jackson's wig and didn't see anything. When all of a sudden, again, according to the guards, he pulled out the gun, pulled off the wig with one hand, pulled out the gun with his second hand, and with what appeared to be his third hand, according to logical common sense, placed the clip inside the gun and said, "This is it. The dragon has come." We read this and we analyzed it, and we looked at all the testimony from everybody who testified at the grand jury, and this just didn't make a hell of a lot of sense. It didn't seem possible that the events could have occurred in the way that was being described by the prison. And there was a great feeling among the six defendants that also, I must say, many and most of the lawyers soon agreed with, that the prison had set up George Jackson in light of the Soledad case, in which he was accused of murdering a guard who was thrown from the tier, and that the idea behind this event was to kill George Jackson in a fake attempt by George Jackson to escape from the adjustment center, and that what happened was that it got out of hand.
You write that he's charged with conspiracy without them specifying who was actually murdered and who was actually all involved in the conspiracy to murder.
Well, one of the things that I focused on very early on in the case is I was put in charge doing a motion to dismiss the indictment because we couldn't tell who Johnny Spain was in conspiracy with, that these six were conspiring with people or person or persons unknown. How do you defend somebody if they're conspiring with people and they're not telling you who the people are? So our argument was we were not put on notice of what their case was really about. They were saying these six people did various bad things, or maybe they didn't do them themselves, but other people with whom they were conspiring may have killed the five people who were killed that day in San Quentin other than George Jackson. But they weren't telling us who the people were. So our question was put in layman's terms this: how the hell can we defend Johnny Spain if he's accused of conspiring with a killer and they're not telling us who they think the killer is? And yet that's the way the case ultimately went to trial.
Can you explain the demurrer and its role?
What we did with the information that we had is we filed what's called a demurrer, which is a legal pleading that attached the indictment itself. And the demurrer was based on this: you have not provided us notice in this indictment of how we can possibly defend the case. By not telling us who the co-conspirators are, you're not giving us notice in a way that makes it fair for us to be able to defend our clients, in this case, Johnny Spain. But it was true of all six of the clients. And this was really a great lesson to me about unfairness. I mean, I had grown up with unfairness. I had grown up seeing and understanding something about the unfairness that people of color faced, the racism that Black people faced, the harder road it was for Black people to travel, and Indigenous people and other people of color. But I had no clue as to the extent of the unfairness. And this was basically a case in which a prosecution was trumped up by a claim that these six men had conspired with people that they weren't going to name. So our motion was a demurrer to set aside the indictment completely because it failed to provide us notice of how to defend the case. I thought it was righteous, but needless to say, we lost. And we lost pretty much every motion that we tried.
One motion that you felt was very, very important, and you talk about it in the introduction right away, about the chaining of the defendants in court and this whole elaborate handcuffing and chaining. Explain.
Well, first, Dan, let me explain the way the chains worked. So when they were brought to court, the six, and in fact, when they were brought to visits in the prison, each of the six, including Johnny, had leg chain running between their legs, attached with ankle braces. They also had a waist chain around their waist, and attached to the waist chain was a short 6 or 8 inch chain that went to handcuffs. So there was a chain around their waist and a short chain on each side going to each of two handcuffs so that they could not extend their arms far enough, really, to even write notes to us without leaning their whole body over and with their arm constricted by the 8 inches, be able to try to write something to us. In addition to that, they also had neck braces that they had to wear. The chains and braces that they had to wear to court weighed 26 pounds. When we were working on motions about the law, the demur, the lack of evidence, the ambiguity of the indictment, the six defendants were most concerned about a motion that they called the unshackling motion. They were most concerned about the chains. And I got to be the lead person in writing that motion because they felt that with all these chains, 26 pounds of weight, that they could not honestly communicate with their own lawyers because the chains were so restrictive that they could neither sit upright in the courtroom, nor could they communicate, and they barely could write by virtue of the waist chains that were attached to the handcuffs. And, you know, I was in that courtroom many, many, many days, and I saw those chains, and they were absolutely right. We asked the judge to make specific findings as to why the chains were necessary. And the judge merely said, these guys are coming over from the Adjustment Center in San Quentin, the most violent place in the entire state prison system, and I'm going to keep them chained in the courtroom. And no inquiry was really held to determine whether the chains were necessary, whether if the chains had been removed, would the defendants have acted out, or whether they would have simply sat there and be able to assist their attorneys. We lost that motion, too.
Tell us about Judge Stoll and his actions regarding these chains.
Well, along the way, my mentor, David Mayer, had an idea to file a motion to set aside the grand jury indictment based on the fact that the grand jury was not a jury of our clients' peers. They were very white. They were very upper middle class. There was no diversity. There was no economic diversity. So David filed this motion saying that the grand jury was not a fair constitution of the population of Marin County as a whole, which did have some poorer areas. Nobody represented on the grand jury. We didn't really think we were going to win that motion, but the motion had the effect of requiring the entire Superior Court of Marin County to remove itself from the case because they had selected the grand jury and therefore were ineligible to rule on its viability. So they brought in a judge from Nevada County, an old retired white-haired fella named Vernon Stoll, who must have been 75 years old at least. And we thought, oh my God, Nevada County, you know, conservative territory, old white-haired judge. Oh, are we in a mess of trouble? But when he got on the bench, the six complained, as they did at the beginning of every single hearing in the courtroom, that the chains on them were too tight. And unlike what Judge Broderick had done, Judge Stoll did something extraordinary. He got up from the bench and he walked down to the well of the courtroom where the six defendants were seated, and he examined their leg chains and their handcuffs personally. And then he turned to the San Quentin guards who were watching them and said, you need to loosen these handcuffs and loosen these chains. And if he had done nothing else, he had earned the respect of each one of those six defendants because he was treating them, the first time they were ever treated this way in the courtroom, he was treating them like human beings.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear from our sponsor. Do you ship product from your business? What if your business was treated like a Fortune 500 company with the discount power and customer service power usually reserved for the giants? What if you could pass on to your customers the money you save on shipping or reinvest those precious dollars back into your company? Main Street Logistics offers their clients unbeatable shipping rates and unparalleled customer service. There's no more need to waste time comparing pricing. With Main Street, you can rest assured that you are getting unparalleled discounts and a dedicated customer service team available to you 24/7, 365 days a year. There is never a need to get frustrated comparing rates or stuck talking to someone at the other end of a generic 1-800 number. Main Street Logistics provides you with the headache-free shipping with the deepest possible discounts. Whether you're shipping within Canada, from Canada, or bringing goods into Canada, Main Street can help. Trust Main Street Logistics for all of your shipping and courier needs, domestic courier, international courior, LTL and FTL, ocean and cargo, warehousing and fulfillment. The Main Street Logistics team brings 25 years of experience to your shipping needs and will help your business punch above its weight. When you work with Main Street, you are treated like a Fortune 500 company, enjoying the discounts and service that a Fortune 500 receives. What I love most about Main Street Logistics is just how immediate, easy, and comfortable it is working with Tom and his partner, Marnie. They get the job done anywhere, anyhow, anytime. If you want to get in touch to see what they can do for you, visit www.mainstreetlogistics.ca. For a 10% discount, use promo code TRUEMURDER in the subject line of your email so that they know your friend Dan sent you. That's 10% off when you go to www.mainstreetlogistics.ca and use promo code TRUEMURDER in the subject line of your email. Main Street Logistics, front of the line, anywhere, anytime. Now, Richard, we were talking about what happens with Judge Stoll and this stay of proceedings again, the stay of this trial. But also, you write next about the issue of segregation.
Right. And in this case, segregation means what they call in the prison system administrative segregation, which is basically isolation, being placed in isolation. So in the adjustment center, there were two tiers. One looked out on a set of windows. One looked out on absolutely nothing. The people with the set of windows were able to go outside once in a while. The people where Johnny Spain and the other six were, had no way of going outside, so there was no outside exercise. These people in segregation suffered, among other things, that they had a half hour of exercise a day, which when it wasn't convenient, they didn't get. That if they had a shower a day, 2 days a week, they didn't get their exercise. When they were removed from a cell, tear gas was routinely used. When they had personal family visits, they were limited to one per week. The cell floors had no drains, and they frequently flooded because of poor pipes. Overflowing toilets were typical. They had no TV. They had no radio. They had no academic or vocational study. And they had two separate script cells, as they were called, which were reserved for people who misbehaved, which had no wash basin and only a hole in the floor for waste elimination, as they called it, and a single 200-watt bulb controlled from outside the cell. These conditions were things that Johnny and I and the other six talked about all the time. They were horrific. And I was tasked near the end of the case to do a writ of habeas corpus petition regarding the conditions of confinement. Habeas corpus, bring the body before the court. Here, not to free the person, but to say these conditions of confinement are unconstitutional and cruel and unusual punishment. And indeed, they were. I can't imagine how any degree of sanity could have been maintained by these six individuals and the other people incarcerated there under these conditions. And eventually, after the case itself, Judge Alfonso Zerpli of the Northern District of California Federal Court agreed and declared most of these conditions unconstitutional and required changes such as outside time and exercise every single day and many other changes that made life a little bit more palatable for people in segregation.
You say that this case, Judge Stoll's decision was eventually overturned, but Johnny succeeded in getting Charles Gary to be his counsel, and David Mayer was relieved of his duties. But during the hiatus in the case, you spent a lot of time with Charles Gary, and he offered you to co-chair or be the second chair on the upcoming trial. What was your decision and why?
Well, first, Judge Stoll, not only did he loosen the handcuffs, but then he did something really incredible. He threw out the indictment and agreed with our theory that the grand jury was not fair. And at that point, there was a break in the action. And Charles Gary, who Johnny had wanted to represent, because Charles had represented Huey Newton and a number of other political figures, and he had this residual suspicion about David because Judge Broderick had foisted David on Johnny. Charles was interested in taking over the case, and I spent a lot of time with Charles during this period of time, talking about the case, hanging out in his office just off of Market Street in San Francisco, and learning a lot about radical lawyering from Charles and his partners, Barney Dreyfus and Frank McTiernan, true lions of the radical left defense bar. When the case started up again, however, I had a lot of doubts whether Charles continued to have the acumen to be able to win the case. I felt strongly that David would win the case. He was a brilliant trial lawyer. But I thought that Charles had lost quite a bit off of his fastball, and I was concerned that he wasn't as familiar with the underlying facts of the case, those 368 pages of the indictment that I was so intimately familiar with. So I had a choice. Either go into partnership with David Mayer, who said, you know, we've been working great. Come on in. You just got sworn in as a lawyer. Be my law partner and we'll try to do some criminal cases together. Or second chairing the case with Charles. And that meant a lot of publicity and a lot of, you know, visibility, but it also meant a lot of heartache. And I was really concerned that it wouldn't wind up well. And so I chose to leave the San Quentin case and go into partnership with David, which turned out to be a really excellent decision.
Absolutely. In the epilogue, you discuss, eventually they went to trial, and the longest criminal trial in California history at that time, several months. And you write that the jury deliberations took over 100 days. Tell us a little bit more what transpired.
Well, the jury deliberations were pretty incredible. The prosecution really didn't have much of a case because it was based on the smoke and mirror aspect of conspirators who were unknown. And while we hadn't won motions about that in the pretrial proceedings, the jury was really troubled by that. So as a result of these long, long deliberations, three of the six defendants were acquitted on every count. And there was something like 50 felony counts. One of the six defendants, named David Johnson, was convicted only of a misdemeanor assault on a guard by kicking a guard, and that's it. He was very quickly released from prison on parole. One of the other six, Yogi Pinnell, was convicted of very serious crimes for cutting the throats of two guards who lived to testify and testified that Yogi Pinnell was the person who had done that. So in this one instance, there was direct evidence that this person had committed that crime. Yogi Pinnell was sentenced to life in prison, which is an appropriate sentence under the law for people who were in those circumstances and committed a crime against a correctional officer, and actually lived for very many years and passed away in prison a few years ago. Johnny Spain, our client, was the only one convicted of murder, of two counts of murder, which was pretty bizarre because he was accused of five, and there was no claim that he himself had committed the murders. And yet he stood convicted as the sole person convicted of murder. But that was just the beginning of that issue. He had a wonderful criminal appeals lawyer named Dennis Reardon, who had sat with Charles Gary and second chaired the trial. And Dennis twice was able to get a federal judge to overturn Johnny's conviction. The second time it was overturned, it was based on the shackling. And Judge Felton Henderson found, as we had moved several years before, that the trial judge, Broderick, had never determined that all of those shackles were necessary, and that having shackled the defendants like this made it impossible for Johnny to truly communicate with his counsel. And there was a lot of evidence about it. There were times when Johnny would say, it's too painful for me to go to court. I'm going to stay in the prison. There were times when he wrote letters to the judge saying, I'm in such pain in the court, I can't communicate with my lawyer. Judge Henderson understood that, reversed the convictions, showed that there was no grounds for the 26 pounds of shackling. And at that point, Johnny was very soon after released from prison when the prosecution declined to re-prosecute him.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You write about March 10th, 1988, and Johnny walking out of prison in Vacaville, California, paroled by order of a Los Angeles judge. Tell us about this meeting. You were there. Your wife was there and others.
Yeah, that was a hell of a great day, Dan. He was no longer convicted on the San Quentin 6 case, although they hadn't yet decided not to prosecute. But he was still in prison based on his original conviction in 1967. Dennis and his investigator, Kathy Kornbliss, did a study showing that everybody in the state prison system convicted of a similar murder at a similar time had already been paroled. And yet the parole board continued to deny Johnny Spain. The only reason could possibly be his San Quentin 6 conviction. But that had been set aside.
Right.
So Dennis went down and found a superior court judge in Los Angeles who was assigned to the case, who ordered the parole board to parole him.
Wow.
So it wasn't the parole board. It was a superior court judge. And on that day in March of 1988, we all gathered at Vacaville. Dennis, his young daughter, Lisa, me, my then wife, Naomi, and a few other friends. And Johnny walked out of Vacaville and got into my car. And there's a picture in the book of me and Johnny hugging at a gas station in Fairfield, California, halfway from Vacaville back to San Francisco, where his parole plan was to live in my home, which he did.
Wow.
For several months. And I can tell you how long ago the picture was taken, because gas at that time was $1.09 a gallon.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see the joy on our faces as we hug. And he came back to San Francisco. He lived in, we actually had to have my two-year-old's room vacated. We gave Johnny that room and got him a telephone. And he came out of prison in 1988. And to this day, he's never gone back. I talked to him last week. He called to wish me a happy birthday, which actually is today. And it's great to have his friendship.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
You write about your San Quentin 6 experience having a enormous effect on you. In what ways do you believe it changed you, really?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, I grew up, and in fact, David grew up in that case. It was necessary, given the political and highly visible nature of that case, and also the equivocal evidence and the really questionable prosecution theory, to file every possible motion on every possible issue, and then to petition for a writ to the higher court on every possible issue. And we did that. We did absolutely everything that possibly could have done, and a few things that we just kind of thought of ourselves. When we were done, David and I realized that every case should be the San Quentin 6 case, that there would be no reason to treat any other criminal defendant or any civil client with less than that kind of full amount of dedication. And so there we were, kind of stuck with this. We've done absolutely everything in our power. And when the next case came along, and I write about this in the second chapter of the case, involving a young Vietnamese kid who was being racially profiled by a bunch of white kids in Marin County, that's exactly what we did. We did the same thing. We pulled out all the stops. We didn't make it easy for the prosecution. We called all the available witnesses and put them on the stand one at a time. David and I learned that that's what it takes. So that's what you do.
You also write in this book, and we don't have much time to go into it, but it's interesting that you apply these lessons and what you've learned in the case of Elvin Drummond and self-defense. Can you talk about that?
Well, Elvin Drummond was a guy who had been working as a security guard, had very little of a record, which for a black man in the 70s in San Francisco was remarkable. He had one drunk driving case. And he came to us and said, you know, my public defender wasn't a public defender. My private appointed counsel is not doing a good job for me. Will you guys take on the case? And a group of us, six of us, took on his case pro bono. And his case was relatively straightforward. He was accused of murdering a fellow named Bo Molson by stabbing him six times in the chest. And all of the stab wounds were very similar. They were the same depth, the same angle, everything else. So that the coroner concluded that either Elvin had held Bo up against a wall or had stabbed him while Bo was on the ground. But we knew that that didn't happen. Elvin was a very small man. Bo stood 6'2 and weighed well over 200 pounds. And Elvin described to us how Bo came after him with a knife, and Elvin was able to duck underneath Bo, kind of like Joe Frazier fighting Muhammad Ali. And boom, 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 boom. Six stab wounds underneath, all similar, because Bo Molson was moving towards Elvin at the time. That's a tough defense. But we absolutely believed Elvin. One of the reasons we believed Elvin was that Bo was Elvin's ex-girlfriend's new guy. And Elvin and the ex-girlfriend had a young child. And Elvin was trying to get visitation with the young child. But in doing it, he always sought out the Legal Aid Society and got a court order to see the child. He never took the law into his own hands.
Right.
And this, if I may, Dan, is where my mother came.
Yes.
So my mother, who was an extraordinary woman, an early medical doctor and a psychiatrist and pediatrician, happened to be out in San Francisco visiting because we had a one-year-old son at that time. She wanted to see her grandson. And she came to the trial and she listened to my closing argument. And by that time, we had developed a witness who said, no, no, Elvin didn't stab Molson while he was on the ground, and he didn't hold him up against the building. The two of them were standing there, which supported our theory. But I hadn't nailed it down. And at lunchtime, everybody on our team was telling me what a great job I had done. Richard, you're really nailing the argument. You're really doing a great job, except for my mom. And my mom said, Rich, listen to me for a second. So, okay, what is it, Mom? You have to go back into the jury. And when you finish up your argument after lunch, you have to say to them, you have to ask them this question. Is Elvin Drummond the kind of person who would take the law into his own hands? And I thought about that. I said, you know, on the one hand, he always went through legal processes to get the order to visit his daughter. And on the other hand, taking the law into his own hands has the second meaning, using the knife aggressively to commit murder. And so the first thing I did that afternoon in wrapping up my summation was to turn to the jury and say, members of the jury, I want you to ask yourself this question. Is Elvin Drummond the kind of man who would take the law into his own hands? And five jurors shook their head no. And I realized that my mom, through me as the vessel, had managed to reach the key of the case.
What was Elvin Drummond's fate? And again, who's there to pick him up?
Well, Elvin got out of jail the night of his acquittal because he had no other holds on him. He committed no other crimes. He came to our home and spent the night at our home. But we knew that Bo had two brothers who had actually shown up at the trial, both of whom had violent felony records.
Yes.
And we're not going to let this go if Elvin were still around. So one of the members of this pro bono team of ours had come from Portland, had a lot of contacts in Portland. And we got Elvin a couple of contacts in Portland, Oregon, got him a bus ticket, told him who to talk to up in Portland, and got him out of Dodge. The bad part of that was it estranged him from his daughter, who he really loved, who was an infant. The good part of that is it was able to save his life, at least at that time. About 10 years ago, I got a call from this woman, and it turned out that she was Elvin's daughter, and had managed to get in touch with him and had continued to be in touch with him after all these years. And that was really, really gratifying to hear, because here was a guy who only wanted to spend some time visiting his daughter, was then accused of murder, almost convicted, and then was able to reunite with his daughter many years later. So every once in a while, stories have at least a partial happy ending.
I want to thank you so much, Richard Zitrin, for coming on and talking about your book, Trial Lawyer, A Life Representing People Against Power, some of the most compelling cases that you have encountered during your life as a trial lawyer. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about this book. For those that might want to take a look at other works of yours or about this case and more in particular, do you do any social media and do you have a website?
Sure. You can read about this book at www.richardzitrin.com. The Zitrin is Z-I-T-R-I-N. It's got this book featured and the other books that I've written. It also has a number of other published articles, but there's more information about this book and some quotes from some good people who enjoyed it. You know, it's available through my publisher, Political Animal Press. It's available on Amazon and all the other usual places. I have an Instagram account, and I have a Facebook page, and I have a LinkedIn page. But the best and easiest thing to do is go to my website, www.richardzitrin.com, and I hope you're interested in following up and reading about some of the other stories, in addition to the full stories about San Quentin 6 and Alvin Drum. And thank you, Dan, so much for asking me about these things.
Thank you so much for coming on and discussing Trial Lawyer, A Life Representing People Against Power. Thank you so much for this interview, Richard Zitrin. You have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.